Welcome to the podcast service of the Massachusetts Climate Action Network. Visit us online at massclimateaction.net or friend us on Facebook.
Hi, and welcome to the Climate Minute, your source for insight and perspective on global warming news. My name is Ted McIntyre, and this show is for the week of July 24th, 2017. Today, we're joined by our new frequent guest, Mariah Tinger. How are you doing, Mariah?
I'm doing well.
And we're joined by our venerable, longtime contributor, Mr. D.R. Tucker. How are you doing, D.R.?
Doing well. How are you doing?
Good, good. Good to have you both here. It's wonderful. So, I have this application on my iPad and my MacBook Pro and my cell phone. It's called Facebook, and it allows me to communicate with people I don't know and say stupid things from time to time, things I wish I hadn't said, stuff like that. And it turns out it was started up by this young gentleman who I guess put in a little time in the Harvard Yard and invented this software there, a guy named Mark Zuckerberg, who has gone on to do lots of other things. But I guess recently he has bumped into some hot water on the climate front. Right, Mariah? Tell me, what did Mark Zuckerberg do, and tell me the story.
So it sounds like Mark Zuckerberg is trying to visit 30 states before the end of the year. And as part of this tour of the country, he stopped by Glacier National Park up in Montana. And he was supposed to meet with Daniel Fagre. I don't know if I'm saying that correctly, F-A-G-R-E. He was supposed to meet with him, who's a research ecologist and a specialist on the impact of climate change. And then all of a sudden that meeting got canceled by the Department of Interior. Daniel Fagre was not really told why it was canceled. It was just sort of like, nope, sorry, you're not meeting with Zuckerberg. And, that was disappointing to Zuckerberg. It sounded like he was interested in hearing a little bit about that. And even though the meeting with the Daniel Fagre, I wish I could figure out how to say his name because I feel bad. But anyways, even with the meeting with him being canceled, Zuckerberg still, I think, applaudably posted about climate change, saying, that the glaciers, there's not as many glaciers here in the park. I don't know the exact words that he said, but that they've gone from 150 down to 25 glaciers, and that it's something that exists and we should be concerned about. So, kudos to Zuckerberg for mentioning it anyway. And, to some degree, I wonder if the fact that the meeting was canceled has heightened the discussion about this.
The story is the evil actor here is Brian Zinke.
Yeah, the Department of the Interior, the head of the Department of the Interior, correct?
Mm-hmm. So, go ahead.
Well, I looked up Zinke a little bit, and it sounds like he was saying that the climate change is not a hoax. He believes in it, and he wants to run the Department of Interior the way Teddy Roosevelt did, that kind of thing.
From a horse?
right. This is definitely sort of an interesting, this certainly doesn't support his philosophy on climate change not being a hoax for him to cancel this meeting.
So, DR, if you had a chance to talk to Mr. Zinke, what would you say to him?
Well, I think I've mentioned before that when it comes to actually doing something strongly about the climate crisis, Ryan's hopeless, so to speak. And he talks about being this sort of Teddy Roosevelt Republican, but he aligns himself with, shall we say, this anti-social network that's running things. It's basically played a role in vetoing the meeting of Mr. Fagre with Zuckerberg. But it's going to be very, very interesting to see as a result of this, and considering how strongly Zuckerberg was impacted by this, whether or not Facebook and whether or not, some of the other activities that he's involved in, is he going to be more verbal, more vocal about the climate crisis in a way that, you know, say a Michael Bloomberg is, or a Richard Branson is. Is this going, you know, he has a young child, you know, it has this sort of, you know, driven home to him the importance of this, and using, you know, his impact, and he certainly has an impact to sort of, you know, raise the awareness that needs to be raised. I mean, we discussed, you know, previously the goal of the writer of that controversial New York Magazine piece to sort of raise awareness about what needs to be done. Could Zuckerberg, in his own way and with his own prodigious power, you know, raise up an awareness that needs to be raised to the level where this becomes a main event topic in our political and social and cultural discussions?
I mean, you have to mention global warming in every Facebook post, or it won't post it on you.
I mean, it's time to face it, because humanity might well end up in the books.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but did I thought Zuckerberg and Gates got together on some clean energy initiatives? Do you guys remember hearing about that?
I think I do recall something to that effect.
Yeah.
I mean, Gates. I also remember Joe Rome Climate Progress basically suggesting that Gates, you know, for all that he does, he could do a whole lot more, considering his influence
Certainly.
On Americans, on worldwide society, to raise awareness about this issue.
But it's an interesting question, which now actually I have two points I want to make. But this, if you look at American history, the question of the great man, because there's been a man, but the great person, right? You've got Andrew Carnegie putting libraries in every little town, and all the Rockefeller Foundation, although that's going to check your history. What is the impact of those well-to-do, successful people on society as compared to the responsibility that the three of us have, right, who are not as wealthy as Mark Zuckerberg, right? I mean, where does the power lie? I mean, should we all be looking and hoping that Mark Zuckerberg funds, you know, climate research? You know, or should we be arguing that money should come out of the common tax? You know, I don't know. I'm just pointing out that there are examples in American history of great benefactors to the society, the people that have made it, right, made all the money they need. But is that how, you know, certainly going forward, is that a way that we should be running the society? Because Zuckerberg gave money, basically gave money to run the Newark school system or something, right? And you say, okay, we're going to privatize this, and it's all going to be handed down from the gentry to the people, all the money, and we don't need tax money. I don't know, man. That's
well.
Go ahead.
Sorry, you know, I guess you look at some of, like, for example, the Koch brothers, right? They funneled their money into the political system and had major influence that way. And I think on sort of another person to look at is Tom Steyer, who has done. Yeah. Similar things, but for climate change. He's got Next Gen Climate and the Tomcat Foundation. And so he's really been working to change the system and to change the political system and the political fabric and how things are talked about. And I think that's very important because if you have that, there needs to be that balance of influence, I guess. To some degree.
It's why I keep buying the lottery tickets so I can win several $100 million and then start the McIntyre Foundation.
I was also thinking of an example of how powerful people can sometimes wake people up in a way that not so powerful people can. And I was thinking about this in the context of Warren Buffett and how many people in this country who dismissed, you know, Occupy Wall Street, who said, is it all, you know, they're just whiners. How many people woke up to the reality of income inequality when Warren Buffett said that he pays a lower tax rate than his secretary? That was a glass of cold water in the faces of a lot of people.
Yeah, and that the tagline, the 1%. Now everybody talks about the 1%. Mm-hmm. We understand that.
Well,
clearly.
But I think it comes back to this issue, and we've touched on it before, of, you know, the trusted authorities. Right? The people that you believe and think make sense, and a lot of people think Warren Buffett makes sense, right? If he says something, it has more credibility, more credence. And that's why the politicians, you know, for better or worse, I mean, there's sort of this synergistic thing, right? The people have to push the politicians, but the politicians have to start saying the words, and then more people, it's reinforced among more and more people. So I agree with you. I mean, the people of stature and influence that are respected, they're respected for a reason, and their word carries weight compared to, you know, somebody who's not so well known.
It's like that old commercial, you know, the old E.F. Hutton commercials. When E.F. Hutton talks, people listen.
So, but let me just go back to the Mr. Stinky or Mr. Zinky there from the Interior Department. Just earlier this evening, in fact, I was reading an article in the Washington Post, an op-ed piece from a scientist. I think it's Joel Clement. But he was a climate scientist in the Interior Department, and he's been doing climate science for, I don't know, 8-10 years, and they just reassigned him to the accounting department to send out bills to the fossil fuel industry. And it's clearly a deliberate attempt to take him out of the science department and put him someplace where he will either quit or go silent, right? And I mean, this is Zinke's, you know, we say Zinke wants to run the Department of Interior like Teddy Roosevelt. What is it, San Juan Hill, Teddy Roosevelt kind of this stuff. But they're doing this thing to destroy the climate scientific, not just climate science, the scientific infrastructure of the federal government to hide the consequences of climate change.
It's Joel Clement is the individual's name, and it's just and it is, and we've made this point before, this an even more extreme and even more dark and vicious version of some of the stuff that went on, particularly in the George W. Bush administration, where climate scientists were routinely being silenced and shuffled around and basically being given the back of their hand by the Bush administration. Now that seems like the good old days.
He looks like Abraham Lincoln now.
So, well, you know, it's one of those things where I can't imagine what it's like to be in that position where you have so much pressure and you feel like maybe you can't do your job the way you want to, but I hope they don't give up. We need them. Go rogue, go underground, you know, but stay with it.
So let's come back. There are two stories that came up here in Massachusetts this past week. One has to do. So let me just set this up, and I'll let one of you two guys to give the information. But of course, there is a glut of pipelines being built across the country. In fact, did you see that they're trying to put a pipeline across the Appalachian Trail through the Blue Hills, the Shenandoah Valley, across the Appalachian Trail? Anyway, they're trying to. It turns out that it's very profitable to build the pipelines. Whether or not there's any gas in them, just building the pipeline is itself a very profitable business. There's a risk of overbuilding the pipelines, yada yada yada. There are several pipelines at least two pipelines that have been proposed for Massachusetts, and of course, along that pipeline, you have to build someplace along the pipeline what's called a compressor station. And what that compressor station does, I believe, is repressurize the gas so that it can be at, 10 or 20 times atmospheric pressure as it goes through the pipelines. These compressor stations can be quite noisy and dangerous, kind of stinky, all kinds of bad things associated with the compressor stations. And there was one proposed for a town called Weymouth, which is just south of Boston, which would be kind of a terminus. I think what they want is this compressor station in Weymouth to pressurize the gas so they can send it up to Canada and export it. But that's a whole other story. DR, did you see anything about what the governor said with respect to this compressor station that's been proposed?
Yes, it has been reported that Governor Charlie Baker has sent a letter to Mayor Bob Hedlund of Weymouth saying that he's ordering state agencies to review the air pollution and potential health impacts of this compressor station. In his letter, Baker reaffirmed his support for natural gas as a solution to the Bay State's energy needs, but he did say that he wants to make sure on the basis of common sense, basically, to ensure that this is not going to pose a risk to the air and safety quality of residents of Weymouth. He did say that the final decision on this will lie with the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, but it has been noted previously that there are certain things that can be done on a state level that can sort of throw some sand in the gears of this. And it has been noted that a similar review of air pollution and health quality played a role in the blocking of an effort to build a hazardous waste incinerator in East Braintree during the Dukakis administration. So it's very interesting to see, and again, it goes to show the you know, public pressure works. Power concedes nothing without a demand, and now this power is conceding that there's a potential risk to this compressor station.
Mariah, do you agree with? I mean, I think that the power of the protesters to get the governor's attention seems to be at play here, right? It's a good thing.
Right, and I know that in the past, Baker has said that he wants to support a lot of the initiatives from the climate change, the Paris Accord, and so on and so forth. So this gives him a chance to sort of show that.
Well, I mean, I think that the support for the Paris Accord and making Massachusetts Paris compliant consists in things like stopping these pipelines, and I think that. I, for my own money, I don't think that Baker would be taking this action if he wasn't feeling the heat, right? If he wasn't feeling the constant, maybe he sees that lady who's sitting outside his office every noontime hoping to speak with him about it, right? I mean, they must be conscious of it in this. So I guess if you're a protester of any pipeline anywhere, take heart. And if you're a protester of the pipelines here in Massachusetts, you should be especially heartened that this you start to see the cracks in the facade, right? When Mr. Baker, who mouths the right words sometimes, we need to force him to take action.
Mm-hmm. To see what happens when you petition for the redress of grievances.
I know. There's something in the Constitution about that, isn't there?
You got it.
So tell me, I have this headline here that says, glass buildings in Massachusetts. Tell me, one of you two explain what that is. DR, what's the story?
Yes, there's a great story in the Boston Globe talking about, you know, the dynamic whereby, and it's a dynamic that isn't often focused upon, that glass buildings, and there are glass buildings being built all over the Bay State, they require a lot of energy to heat and cool. Mm-hmm. And people have pointed out that if you wanted to do something serious about making buildings more energy efficient, perhaps you would put, no one's saying, you know, build buildings without glass, but build buildings with substantially less glass than is currently being used, because, you know, a lot of buildings that are full of glass and are leads get good LEED certifications for being, you know, energy mm-hmm. efficient. They get that certification despite all the glass, mm-hmm. not because of it, because of just the expense. And obviously, you know, because of the cost and because of, you know, status quo thinking, there's going to be that inclination to try to use dirty energy to sort of heat and cool these buildings. And it's just something that people often don't think about. They just think about the aesthetic and esoteric qualities of the glass, and they don't think about how the design of these buildings may be significantly contributing to climate change. In fact, the Globe points that the building sector, quote, consumes nearly half of the energy, produces 45% of greenhouse gas emissions to the United States. And even though many architects have signed on to an industry challenge to become carbon neutral by 2030, a lot of new buildings are slipping way behind the targets to get there. So,
and what do you got, Mariah?
Go ahead. Well, so I actually worked in a LEED Platinum certified building that was all glass, 100%, you know, there's one thing I will say about it. It's the passive solar that happens from all glass, of course, is a benefit. And mm-hmm. the way that this building was set up is it had basically an envelope around it. There were two glass walls with an air trapped in between, and then a system that helped sort of shuttle the air throughout the building. I agree. I think, I'm not sure if I think it's U value. What do they call it? The insulation.
Value.
Well, the R value is for walls, but I think glass has a different value. I'm not sure exactly what it is, but it's much less than glass. It's certainly much less. So, you know, that is definitely a balance. You get the passive solar, but you lose a lot of the insulative property of a wall. So I don't know much about architecture, but that's a dance they do have to play with.
We need to get an architect in here, because I guess it seems to me that, I mean, you can make solar panels that are transparent, right? They go on your glass. And I think the passive solar, especially if you have the right kind of blinds that sort of keep the heat out, you know, keep the direct sunlight out in the summer and let the, but then the, so I guess I'm confused. Having not read the article, I need to form an opinion. Maybe we need to get an architect in here. I know a couple. I know some guys who might have an opinion here. That'd be interesting to hear what they say.
You know, and the other thing about a glass building is, I mean, I agree with you, Ted, that the building I was in had extensive blind systems. They actually tracked the sun and closed and opened based on the sun. So it was pretty advanced that way. But they also had to think about birds and all the birds that fly into glass, right? Yeah. So, and of course, the lights, they had the blinds set so that they would shut down at a certain time at night to help with light, reducing light pollution as well. Because you have a building that's all glass, all that light is just going out into the night sky. So less people should work late, perhaps.
Yes. Well, I guess the only other thing I would say about those glass buildings, the people inside those glass buildings should never throw any stones, right? Which is not a good thing. All right, we got to leave it there. Let me remind everyone that we'll put up the links at least to some of the crazy stuff we talked about at the blog. It's at massclimateaction.org/blog. You can find us on our Facebook page at /massclimateaction and click through to the blog and the podcast, which is on SoundCloud there. You can listen to us directly on your smartphone using Stitcher, TuneIn Radio, Overcast, Podbean, SoundCloud, blah, 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 all those directories. You can find us on iTunes by searching for Massachusetts Climate Action. So we will close the way we always close, by saying that because we recognize the necessity of personal accountability for our actions, because we accept responsibility for building a durable future, and because we believe it's our patriotic duty as citizens to speak out, we must insist that the reckless policies of the new administration not be accepted as normal, and that the United States put a long-term and equitable price on carbon. So thanks for being here, DR.
Thanks.
Mariah, thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
And thanks to all you guys for listening. We'll talk again soon. Bye-bye.
Thanks for being with us. And until next time, be green.
Very cool.